Masalama, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is goodbye in Arabic, literally with peace, as we say goodbye to the 2022 season and a whole grip of drivers. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, hello, Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing good. Buikas la dia. While we're having hellos and goodbyes in foreign languages that invoke the word of God. I'm good. The season's over. I feel bereft already. I'm not sure what to do with myself. Sundays have a vacuum in them that will never be filled.
Also joining us, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
I'm good. I'm glad F1 is over.
Counterpoint.
You know, this is what you get from Shift F1. Just a whole lot of differing opinions. If you are new to the podcast, a very warm welcome to you. If you're new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer. I mean, like I said last week, if this is your first episode, you've got a whole series to binge. You can go listen to our preseason primer and then watch the whole season. The primer assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So you don't need to know anything about F1 before getting into that. This year's primer is episode 178, or you can just stick around a few more months and wait until next year's primer. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. What's going on this month, Danny?
Yeah, sign up and get access to a year's worth of bonus podcasts we've done. And among other things, myself and Drew drinking wine in my old backyard in Oakland.
That's right. Daniel Ricciardo's wine, no less.
Exactly, Daniel Ricciardo's wine. Remember that guy? He used to race in Formula One. But this week we have a rather bemusing and terrific review of the original 1964 Gone in 60 Seconds, a movie is just beggar's belief. Just to give you, I know we've talked it up, but just I don't think I've ever specifically said it's a movie made by a guy who owned a junkyard and wanted to make a movie like his favorite old Hollywood movies, and then he did. He just did it. He just trashed a bunch of cars. He spent years hoarding ex-cop cars and ambulances and created a movie which has the longest chase scene in cinema history. I believe it is 45 minutes. It is full of crashes that genuinely hurt people. It is a ridiculous movie.
It's unbelievable. I don't know why I'd never heard of it before.
It's so strange.
The guy, so weird, and I'm so glad. This
gentleman passed away during the filming of the sequel. Like, it is all of the elements of like an American cult classic. But if you, it's like Google, it's like how the internet can like swallow up memory, because like, The Nicolas Cage Gone in 60 Seconds looms so large that like it just shadowed that story. So, which is clearly the story that got this other one made.
And a way better story.
It's wild. What a wild, wild movie. And thanks to all of our incredible. I don't even have a sore throat. You just coughed before we started. Now suddenly I've got the plague.
It's the time of the season.
So I will also say, like, the air has dried out completely in my apartment. And so I've got a scratchy throat and everything, just because, it's the time of year where I need to keep a pot of water on a low simmer, like, the entire day. Or it is just unbearable in here and all my electronics just, like, zap me.
Oh my God! You're right. That's probably what I was. I got zapped by the microphone when we started. So I think you're right.
Yeah, that might be. That air is just like hella dry. I think
dry air, man.
Or you're in the movie Pulse.
I've never seen that. Pulse? What happens in that?
It's basically like, I think, is it Maximum Overdrive where all the machines come to life? It's like that, but like household electronics.
Oh no! Oh yeah, it's zapping me. I hope not. I am surrounded by electronics. I will die.
There might be a ghost. I don't know.
It's usually a ghost. There's no ghost in Gone in 60 Seconds, except for the ghost of filmmaking, which died during, I don't know. Anyway, thanks to all of our incredible title sponsors. At Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, At Talking Autos, Olivia Evans, Pyrites, Card Castle, Iron Station Studios, Alan McCrary, TelemetryDeck.com, David Mule, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foote, Abdullah Althani, here's the crew, Jason Chadwick, appreciate you putting your name back, it was quite a long thing I had to say before, Abraham Getchell, Enzo and Ayrton, Bunny is thankful for, Sniggs, Alex Goucher, Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, Umberto Roca, William Romph, Irvine, Clinical Research, Lachlan the Maddened Man, and Jason Kelly. Thank you all so much. It's not the final episode of the year, but it is the penultimate one, so thank you very much.
Yes, indeed. We thought that, you know, going through, because there's just so much to talk about in Abu Dhabi. We wanted one more episode.
I can't tell.
Yes, it is.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Sorry, you finish your point first. Sorry, well, I forgot I had a podcast.
It's all right. Yeah, we're doing one more episode. It'll just be like a an emails episode. So if you have any thoughts at the end of this season or questions for us, let us know using the shiftf1podcast@gmail.com email address or f1.cool/emails. We'll be doing that. And we'll also be kind of like doing an informal look back on the season, the storylines, what we want to see from next season, maybe some predictions, who knows. Yeah, just sort of like a little capper episode, because it feels like, I don't know, we did this last year where we did Abu Dhabi and then bailed, you know,
Peaced out.
It felt like, yeah, it didn't feel like a proper cap to the season. So we'll be doing an episode next week. But before we do that, let's do this one, starting with the grid for the final race of the 2022 season. What do you know? I wonder how often this has happened over the
past. I feel like it's never a good sign when it does. I will say this. When I was watching qualifying and I was watching the teams like filter in two by two,
yeah,
I was like, this seems like a very deterministic qualifying.
Yeah, it's like it took the whole season for everyone to figure out their proper place, you know. So the top six is Red Bull, Ferrari, Mercedes of Verstappen, Perez, Leclerc, Sainz, Hamilton, Russell. Then we've got Lando Norris in seventh, kind of the hanger on of Formula 1.5, I guess.
Right.
Esteban Ocon in eighth, Sebastian Vettel in ninth, reaching Q3 in his final qualifying session since he is retiring. After this race, Fernando Alonso in 10th, his last race with Alpine before he moves to Aston Martin next year. Then we've got Yuki Tsunoda in 11th, Mick Schumacher in 12th, good qualifying for his last race with Haas. He has no seat for next year. Daniel Ricciardo in 13th, his last race with McLaren. He also has no seat next year. He was also penalized three places for causing a collision with Magnussen in the previous round, so he actually qualified 10th and is starting 13th. Lance Stroll in 14th, Zhou Guanyu 15th, Kevin Magnussen 16th. 17th is Pierre Gasly in his last race with AlphaTauri before he moves to Alpine next year. Valtteri Bottas 18th, Alex Albon 19th, and Nicholas Latifi in 20th place, his last race with Williams, no seat for next year.
Yeah.
Danny, do you want to take us through the start of Abu Dhabi?
Oh my God, do I want to? So here's I tell you my deep regret of this weekend.
Whoa,
is that, okay. Well, not regret, just mostly, I don't know. I'm glad that there was nothing really up for grabs this weekend, because, I mean, there was some interesting like constructors and driver position things. We got Leclerc and Perez going at it. We got some battles, you know, down further field. Haas are trying to retain their, Alpha are trying to retain their spot. They're in a weird position where they're like drawing maybe, but have a better result. Oh, there's a couple of little bits and bobs down there. But my terrific wife booked a camping trip this weekend, not knowing that it was the last race of the Formula One weekend and the first weekend of the World Cup, which are two things that I'm quite interested in. So I did not tell her. And then tried very sneakily in the middle of the Mendocino woods to try and watch the highlights of all of these things as they were going on. So my every week I usually watch everything. My information this week is entirely based on highlight videos, so I apologize in advance. But as for the first lap, like the orderly qualifying, everyone was orderly through the first couple of turns. I think Lando made up a place on Russell, if I remember correctly. But apart from that, everyone was pretty fine. Perez and Leclerc had a little bit of a go in on the reprofiled turn. I want to say six or seven or five, I think it is the one that
there used to be the chicane heading into the hairpin, and now there's sort of
I forgot to mention that one last week. Yeah, I forgot that they changed three parts of this track, including this. There was a great video on. I think WTF1's YouTube channel was a sponsored bit about the Formula One video game, but they had Charles Leclerc talking about the track. And every time they were like, "Oh, they reprofiled that section. Do you like that?" And he was like, "No, it was better before." he was like, "I love all those chicanes. I missed them, but it's fine, whatever." They all went around and didn't crash into each other. The start of things to come.
But it wasn't long before we got some real good dust up between Hamilton and Sainz there. And sort of a replay of last year's brush with Verstappen, really.
Yes.
As he heads into that left right hander.
Old Hamilton trick.
Well, I am curious what y'all made of this, because it was kind of interesting how it was played. So Sainz comes down fast on the inside, heading into the left hand corner at the end of the straight, and to me it looks pretty 50-50. Like they're pretty much side by side through the next corner, through the left hander, and then Sainz brings it over to make the right-hander and runs Hamilton out wide over the curb. Hamilton's car seems to vault 3 feet in the air. Like, that thing just, jumps as the floor plating hits the curb. It jumps, it bounces hard, and Hamilton straight lines the second corner and comes out ahead of Sainz. And what's interesting is we get two separate reviews of the incident. It was... And I'm not sure. I kind of dig it, because it was like one of the times where it has been clearest what the thought process the stewards are following has been, where you can see first they're trying, they investigate whether or not Hamilton was forced off the track by Sainz. And they decided he didn't. And then Hamilton is directed to give the place back.
Hmm.
Yeah, which he does around lap four. But yeah, it's one of those it's times like this where I really notice in stark relief that I am not a Formula One driver or that I'm not a racing driver at all, because I don't know what kind of sixth sense these guys have. Like I surmise that Hamilton probably knew that someone was going to try a move like that. And if you are polite, you would know that's happening, check it, and, oh, this person's coming through, then I'll slow down because I don't want to go off track. But that's not how racing drivers work. They're like, nope, this is mine. I'm staying here. And then by the time Carlos Sainz pulls even with Hamilton, he has no choice but to go off onto the curb to avoid colliding with Sainz.
Well, he has a choice, because he can slow down. Like, that's Hamilton never does. But in those moments where they're side by side, Hamilton can ease out of the back out of the corner. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And he chooses not to.
He always chooses not to. And it's the reason we've had these fights between him and Verstappen, where everyone's throwing up their version of events, in the fandom, because neither of them ever give an inch.
Yeah,
no, Senna, acolytes. You know what I mean?
Well, in this specific corner, configuration just generates these incidents, because it is always. The fact that the relative positions flip heading into the second turn, I think always makes this so confusing. To me, it was odd that it was an open and shut. He now had to give the position back, which I guess, you know, he did hold on to the position by going off, but yeah, like there was not a lot of room. He could have backed out, but at the same time, the weird thing about these corners is it wasn't like he was taking a crazy wide line to the first corner. He just couldn't turn in as much to make the second corner. And I guess, you know, maybe that is just tactically what should be the dynamic of corners like this. Whereas if a guy can seize control of that middle and inside line heading into the first one, he's gonna complete the pass in the second, and you can't just like white knuckle and try to hold it. Which, you know, I guess that's very consistent with the Max ruling last week in some ways, right? Where, you know, if you got into trouble in the second in the second turn, that's on you, buddy.
Yeah, and like nobody thinks that Sainz forced him off the track. It was a good overtake, and also it seems pretty clear that he got the place back because he just cut the track. So to me, this was very good. Give it back. Sainz was apparently thought that Hamilton gave the position back in a cheeky spot, because then he managed to get a couple of DRS runs on him to basically make the move stick later. Which I thought was funny.
That's a good point, though, because that was right around the time. So you're right. You know, we had, so in this, like, we also get, I'm just going to put a marker here. That jump that Hamilton's car made just stuck in my mind, and it wasn't long before he started saying things that made you wonder how it came down. The other thing that starts to unfold here, though, incredible Esteban Ocon, Sebastian Vettel. Duel happening all around the track, lap after lap. And look, I know we're all getting sentimental because Seb's retiring, but there was a part of me this whole weekend where it's like, look at that guy. He's still got it. He's still great. We just need to get him. Like, we just need to get him on a decent car with good, like, with good vibes. Because I think, you know, he was unfortunate in his timing at Ferrari in a lot of ways. The tail end of the Alonso era and the start of the Vettel era, I do not think, are banner years for Ferrari. But this duel was a reminder of, like, and really his performance in qualifying too. Like, he is still such a smooth driver who can hook it up so completely and maintain these like blistering paces for lap after lap. And the Ocon duel was a real taste of that. And all I could think was, Vettel deserved a better car than that Aston. Like, it's so frustrating watching. He can do everything right. He seemed to have complete command of the car, the track this week. But that Aston, it almost just feels like it runs out of gas at key moments, right? It just gets like a sprinter whose conditioning is bad. It just comes up short in these in these clinches.
I just want to make one note on the Hamilton thing you mentioned. So I saw an interview with him after the fact where he did say, after he had that bottom out, that he basically had too much front end grip, I'm pretty sure he said, and that they dialed it back with the front wing on his first stop, and then he said he got his balance back. So you're right, Rob. Apparently after he had that, there were some issues with the car that had to be rectified. But yeah, classy Seb Vettel. Post race, there was lots of, like, you know, on the F1 YouTube channel and stuff, lots of conversations about Sebastian this and that, and everyone was saying, like, he's a fair racer, you know what I mean? As tough as he is, he's fair. And I think when we look at the Hamilton Verstappen battles, and I want to stop ragging on him as much as I can, but I think that is a question people come up with a bit more, which is, like, you know, they're both tactical and smart. I don't think people would say they're necessarily fair, which I think is a fair thing to say, and Vettel kind of is. But then also Vettel can be now, because he's not fighting for championships. You know, let's rewind the clock 8 years and see how fair he was when he was first or second championship, you know.
Well, and also, like, I mean, you saw famously when he was in the hunt in that year with Ferrari, you saw the elbows got very sharp, maybe self-destructively.
That is true, especially that Ferrari stint, you're right. Yeah,
and talk about not playing nice with your teammates.
Yeah.
Multi-21.
Good point. This is, he became the villain of F1 because he was like sticking the blade in Mark Webber every chance he got. The other thing I'll call out though is, so, you know, you have the You're right. So Hamilton makes life hard on Signs. And also he and Russell get into it a little bit, but the speed differential between them seems really shocking. And I was wondering if it was just like battery dynamics, but it's around this time that Hamilton starts to complain that like he's saying he's down on power. And the commentators were mentioning that, well, it's, again, probably is the battery from these last few laps he's turning, but his pace looked so off, and he kept saying like something's wrong with the car, and I'm immediately thinking there's so much delicate equipment in these cars that are meant to take certain types of force and load and impact, but like the car being dropped like a child's toy is not quite one of them. And I did wonder, and later, you know, with how the race eventually turns out, you know, I still wonder if that trip over the curb didn't pretty profoundly unsettle the car for the duration of the race.
Yeah, well, Hamilton is passed by Russell, perhaps suffering from some floor damage on lap 9. Russell passing with DRS for 5th place. Some of Russell's work is undone, however, by a poor pit stop on lap 16, which concludes with him being released unsafely into the path of Norris, earning him a 5-second penalty.
Not awesome.
Not awesome. Lap 23, Alonso shaking things up by passing Tsunoda and Bottas in the same corner.
God, that was cool.
Yeah.
At the end of the back straight. Unfortunately for him, five laps later, Alpine call him in to retire the car for a suspected water leak.
We haven't really touched upon a really important factor in this season at all. What do we think of Valtteri Bottas' mustache?
Hey, I like it. I think he looks great. And I think, like, mustachioed Valtteri seems like it's all of a piece with him just getting more settled in and comfortable the Mercedes pressure cooker.
Yeah, it's kind of his old man phase, I feel like.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just going to sit here in next to this like mountain brook. I'm not putting pants on.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it.
Maybe he watched Gone in 60 Seconds.
Yeah.
1974 and was like, I need one of those mustaches.
That guy's coolest.
That guy's rad. I want to be that guy. But also I want my car to be able to be okay if I wrap around a pole.
Well, yeah.
So here's the other thing, though. I actually enjoyed this race quite a bit, but like, again, my F1 fandom is forged in the darkest days of strategy races. Like, so, like, I cut my teeth on races where it's like, ooh, how much fuel are they going to put in it, do you think? What, like, obviously, we all know nobody's overtaking on the track this race, but I wonder what will happen with pit strategies. But one of the things that emerged in this first stage of the race is kind of the question of, is anyone going to be trying to one-stop? Is a one-stop really viable here? What strategies are actually in play? And it did not feel like the teams were necessarily confident of the answers they'd come up with. But you know, as we start to see the pit stops filter in, you do have this like looming question of who's going to try to stretch this out. And you know, one of the people evidently doing that is Sebastian Vettel, who, you know, after an early stage of the race and doing really well on those medium tires for a while, he just starts getting gobbled up by everyone, and it crosses that line. He kind of ends up going over the cliff, right, where his lap times are so off the race pace that he is beginning to just he's like losing an entire pit stop. You know, he's basically losing the time on the track that he would probably lose in the pits. And you know, it's this big gamble of if he stretches those mediums out, will he be sort of in the sweet spot with the hards for long enough to make up this damage, and will they have the kind of sweet spot that makes that viable? And you know, I think their strategy was probably the boldest I saw this weekend. It was a real, we are going to try to get you pretty high up in the standings under this theory that by going deep in stint one, we're going to have a great overall race pace. And that prospect started to look real dicey as you just see him plummeting in the laps before his pit stop.
Yeah, there's another big pit stop battle going on with Leclerc and Perez.
Mm-hmm.
Leclerc is told to box opposite Perez. And Mattia Bonato said after the race, team principal of Ferrari, that that was a dummy. That they did that to force or to trick Red Bull to come in, to pull Perez in for a two-stop, because Ferrari, I guess, was committed to doing a one-stop with Leclerc. So we'll see how that shakes out. Lap 28, Vettel still making moves on people, diving down the inside of Gasly for 13th place on lap 28. Lap 39, Mick Schumacher closes up to Latifi as they head into the hairpin and just gives him the slightest of taps to the rear, which is enough to spin both cars, earning Schumacher a 5-second penalty in his maybe last race.
Spinning them both out of F1. Just a nice little pirouette for the fans.
Yep.
And a wave. I know, yeah. Just, it's, yeah, 100% donuts on Mick. Silly mistake. Didn't, just, yeah, shame. Absolute bummer. The whole past couple of races have just been a bummer if you're a Mick Schumacher fan.
I would say the whole season, perhaps.
Yeah. There were high moments. He got that 1 point in Silverstone, was it? You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's not been great.
Lap 44, Vettel is not done overtaking people, this time getting around Zhou on the outside into turn 9 and into the points. But as I said, probably the biggest fight we're watching this race is Perez versus Leclerc for second place in the championship. By lap 45, Perez is sitting in fourth, having done that two-stop strategy to the one-stop of Leclerc, who's sitting in second. Crucially for Perez, he's got to get by Hamilton and takes the opportunity to pass on the inside of the chicane. But Hamilton gets DRS for the next straight and retakes the place. Perez also locking up, I think, into that corner. On the next lap, Perez has DRS into turn 9 and this time makes it stick. Lap 49, Stroll, who's on himself a two-stop, gets by his teammate Vettel, who is doing that one-stop. Stroll into 10th with DRS, jeopardizing Vettel's ability to score points in his final race. But Vettel gets some help on lap 55 as Hamilton radios that he is no longer able to shift, his team suggesting that he might have a hydraulic problem. Hamilton then slowly makes his way back to the pits, but has to retire, elevating Sebastian Vettel to 10th place to score points in his final race. But he is not done. Down to the final turn, fighting with Daniel Ricciardo for 9th place. This was great. In the end, it wasn't close enough. But still, as good a result, I think, as could be expected. And cool to see him going down, fighting with a former teammate, nonetheless. Back in the podium places, Perez can't quite close the gap to Leclerc as they come home 3rd and 2nd to Verstappen, who we barely saw the entire race. Of course, Verstappen could have slowed down toward the end of the race and backed Leclerc up into Perez, but he doesn't, saying after the race in this quote from race fans, quote, "That is quite a tricky call to make. Of course, you can possibly block, but I mean, is that fair racing? I think it's not the nicest way going out of the season like that."
Which, I don't disagree with him. I think it would have been quite a backup he would have had to have done.
He was like
fairness.
7 seconds ahead.
That would have been an absurd call. That would have been an absurd call.
Yeah, it would have been ridiculous. But obviously, in this hyper divisive world of F1 we live in, it is very funny to hear that and then think about how Perez won him the championship last year by backing up Hamilton.
Yeah.
But I do think they are. It's an apples to orange, you know what I mean?
Comparison. Yeah, no, it's not Perez a fair comparison. Perez was fighting a holding action last year to stop Hamilton from running away from Verstappen.
Yeah.
And this would have been impossible. This just ends with Verstappen losing the race. Basically just like he ends. The real issue is, and this came to pass exactly, for Sergio, he needed to give him some extra points last week. That was the opportunity they could have done it. That was when manipulated it. Yeah, and he was like, of course I'll help him in Abu Dhabi. And it's like, F1 doesn't work that way. Like, it's actually pretty rare that you can just like strategize that way. And by not making that call, you know, he does kind of leave Sergio in the lurch. But like, hey, you know, the funny thing is the one stopper thing, everyone seemed really on the edge with it. You know, you had Hamilton being like, please do not leave me out on the one stop. And it was clear they had left him out on the one stop. They were not bringing him in. Leclerc also was kind of white knuckling it, you know, there toward the end as, you know, Perez was trying to run him down. But, you know, after a season really of dodgy Ferrari race calls, and getting a bit wrong here, they seem to get it pretty right. Like, you know, from where qualifying ended up, to be able to get Leclerc up there in the second on the back of a strategy call, and sticking by it, you know, obviously the most credit probably goes to Leclerc for maintaining that kind of pace over that long stint and dealing with that kind of deck. But you know, if the crisis at Ferrari really centers on ability to call a race strategy, they did that pretty effectively here.
Yeah, I agree.
For sure.
Vettel does some donuts for the crowd and a lovely curtain call, putting a cap on his Formula One career. But in the end, the result of the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix looks like this. Max Verstappen in first, Charles Leclerc in second, Sergio Perez rounding out the podium. Behind them, we've got Carlos Sainz in fourth, George Russell in fifth, then Lando Norris, Esteban Ocon, Lance Stroll, Daniel Ricciardo, and Sebastian Vettel rounding out the top 10. Behind them, Yuki Tsunoda in 11th, Zhou Guan Yu in 12th, Alex Albon in 13th, Pierre Gasly 14th, Valtteri Bottas 15th, then Mick Schumacher, Kevin Magnussen, Lewis Hamilton with a DNF, Nicholas Latifi with a DNF, and Fernando Alonso not classified with a DNF. Lando Norris, additional point for the fastest lap of the race.
Oh, nice. Cool. I did not know that.
And that's your Abu Dhabi, and that's your season 2022. Let's go to the driver standings. Max Verstappen, of course, the championship winner, is in first place with 454 points at the conclusion of the season. Charles Leclerc in second with 308 to Sergio Perez 305. George Russell finishes in fourth place with 275 points. Carlos Sainz in fifth with 246. Lewis Hamilton just behind in sixth place with 240 points. Lando Norris in that coveted seventh position with 122 points. Esteban Ocon finishes eighth with 92. Fernando Alonso, his teammate, in ninth with 81. That's, you know, pretty good for Ocon beating the two-time world champion.
Yeah.
Valtteri Bottas
finishes his best buddy.
Finishes in 10th place with 49 points. That's quite a gap there.
Finishes. I get it.
Oh, very nice. Then we got a tie between, guess who? Daniel Ricciardo and Sebastian Vettel, 37 points. Kevin Magnussen, 13th with 25 points. Pierre Gasly, 14th with 23. Lance Stroll, 15th with 18. Then another tie between Mick Schumacher and Yuki Tsunoda in 16th and 17th with 12 points. Zhou Guan Yu, in 18th place with 6 points, Alex Albon with 4, Nicholas Latifi and Nick DeVries with 2, and Nico Hülkenberg with 0.
You'll probably get some more next year. And also, we should mention those aren't technically ties, because in both cases, the driver's top position, I think it is what delineates who was higher.
Right, or like, yeah, more 5th places than 6th places, you know, stuff like that. 2022 constructor standings. Red Bull Racing finishes on top with 759 points to Ferrari's 554. They stay ahead of Mercedes in third with 515. Alpine finishes fourth with 173 points. McLaren fifth with 159. Here's another tie. That's not really a tie, I guess. Alfa Romeo in sixth with 55. Aston Martin in seventh with 55. I imagine those also are cumulative, you know, race finishes, average finish position, something like that.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, top one, I think, again, because Bottas talked afterwards about how at a certain, because he was out of the points as well, and he was at a certain point, he was just like, I'm just going to drive and not try and crash into anyone, because I think if we end now, we're okay. We'll be good. So he said, yeah, it was pretty chill second half to the race.
Gene Haas and team finish eighth with 37 points. Amazing. AlphaTauri ninth with 35. That's a matter of millions of dollars. So
yeah,
that's important. Williams in 10th with 8 total points.
Sell. Darlton Capital, get out. You gotta find somebody to buy this.
They're still in the building phase. They're still in the building phase. It's okay. Next year's car. Next year's car.
It's done. You gotta find someone to come in and sort this situation. Here's the other thing. I need to, you know, I guess when we would talk about our season recap next week, something I'm gonna I want to pay a little more attention to when I sort of review this season is, should we be concerned about AlphaTauri? You know, I feel like a few years ago they were,
yeah,
Red Bull 1.5, right? Where like up there, you know, obviously you had weird circumstances that led
Gasly won a race,
right? Yeah, and that required some like DNFs, but yes, they were up there. You know, pretty high in the top 10, pretty routinely fighting for meaningful positions.
They finished sixth in the driver or constructors championship last year.
Yeah, and the come up, you know, like behind Haas at the end of this year. Now, admittedly, Haas tanked a year and also effectively had one driver for a year. But like, yeah, I don't know, the fall off of form at AlphaTauri, I find a little bit. A little bit alarming if I'm a fan there, and I do think they're an interesting team. It's kind of shocking to see how far they've plummeted toward, you know, real like kind of where you expect a support team to exist, and I wonder what that holds.
Yeah.
Well, while we're on the subject of standings, I'm gonna finish off our fantasy league standings here. The season has concluded.
Wow.
What and from Abu Dhabi, here's the podium. In third place, Patrick's team from America, putting it all on red. In second place, from America, Rajiv's team, Scuderia Eleuthazen.
Wait, where did this team come out of? I've never heard of them before.
I know. This is Abu Dhabi, not the overall.
Oh, sorry.
Standings.
Okay.
And then in first place in Abu Dhabi from the UK, Keith's team, Splash and Dash 2.
All right. Better Keith than Splash and Dash 1, and presumably 3 and 4.
To refueling. Mm. But the podium overall in our fantasy league, you know what? I'll do the top 10.
Yes. They all deserve it. They all deserve it. Sorry, 11.
I need to set a reminder to do this next year.
I'm just bad at it.
I need something to really tune me in to what's happening at the back of the pack, because I'm gonna moneyball my fantasy F1 strategy. I'm gonna be like, who's gonna provide the most value, in these races? Alex Albin, I got big plans for you, son.
All right, yes, the top 10 from our fantasy league overall season standing, starting with number 10, Scott's team. From Canada. Started from the Bottas, now we're here.
Terrific. Good stuff. We should be at separate table for best names, but you're all winners, really, in my eyes.
Yeah. In ninth place, from Puerto Rico, Speedy G's team, Justice 44 Hamilton.
Whoa, that's intense.
From America, in eighth place, James's team, Maximum F. Vert.
Yeah, I love that. Love that all year.
Seventh place from America, Andy's team. Now this is pod racing. And we've got actually a pair of teams from Scott S.
Wow.
From
consistency.
Canada. Amazing. Both named Bottas beats Battlestar Galactica.
Accidentally submitted the same team twice. Don't worry about it. Hey, look, you knocked number 11
scores
off the top 10 with your administrative error.
then actually... Check this out. Three of the top four teams are owned by Robert S. from Canada.
Wow. Is it the same line out of drivers, I wonder?
probably
stacking
not.
Stacking the deck.
But yes, Robert's team in fourth place is called Donkaseb and Mick, Nick, and Danny Rick. In third place, Robert's team, see you next season, Speedy Race Car fans. In second place, from Canada, Michael's team, Leo Speed. And in first place, overall, with 4,640 points.
Wow.
Robert's team from Canada, thanks for the podcast, Danny, Drew, and Rob. Thank you so much, Robert.
Rigged. Yes. Rigged.
Thank you for changing all your Henry names works. In the last week. That's rad. Yeah, fair play to you all. I don't know how people consistently stay at the top of that. There's a lot of people. How many people not? Do you know how many people are in our league?
I just closed it. Let me look.
Yeah. It always seems like an intimidating amount, or I just do not understand how someone gets in like the one percentile, let alone the top 10.
It says 4,540.
Jeez.
But I don't know if that's teams or people, because you can put in, oh yeah, it's 4,536 teams.
Whoa.
And you can put in up to three teams.
Wild. You're all wild people.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right. Well, speaking of drivers, teams, and the rankings they're in, let's get to the news. Rob, we finally have confirmation here from Haas.
Yeah. No surprises here. This is basically leaked to press last week, but Nico Hülkenberg is re-entering F1 with Haas. One more chance to just throw it in the face of probably those teenagers or college kids now who were so mean to him at that Windows store back in 2016.
Oh my God! All those kids are now, yeah, they're all ancient. They all have office jobs.
How you like me now? I'm racing for Haas. But you know, the funny thing is, so he gave a little more detail about how this all came together. It really does seem like, it does not seem like the fix was in. It does seem like Haas was really weighing its options through this year, but apparently they reached out to him in the summer, just gauging interest. So he reached out to Günther Steiner, actually, sort of explained that he might have some interest in coming back. And you know, apparently, like, talks sort of progressed through the year. Haas had a few options that they were considering. There was we didn't really get into it, but Giovinazzi was in the picture there for a while. But ultimately, they brought him back. I think the teams already did their tests where the drivers for next year take a couple laps at Abu Dhabi in the this year's cars. Yeah. But it's an interesting move. And obviously it leaves Mick without a seat. Now Toto Wolff has like sort of extended the possibility that Schumacher might be able to get a gig with a as a reserve driver or a test driver. Which is a sweet gesture. I don't know. I don't know what the future actually holds for Mick. Like we've talked about it on the one hand, it's a tough market. A lot of young drivers just entered the sport, so it seems like getting new seats is going to be harder than it was necessarily this year. Also, like, I don't know. Did we see enough of Mick? Before we go to get to Hülkenberg, I'm curious, like, do we feel that, like, is Mick a known quantity, or is this one of the situations where it was a really compromised time in F1?
You got to compare someone against a teammate, and like, I think he comes out pretty unfavorable. And it's not like Magnussen it's not like K-Mag is like this like absolute, you know, gilt-edged driver. It's, you know what I mean? Like, the gap that's there is just a little bit too much. And and mistakes. There was a lot of mistakes, a lot of unforced errors all the way to the final race with like a silly little incident. Like wanted, like so many people, for Mick to like clean this up and be in there, but his mentality never seemed to help either. Like very down on himself, very, you know, sort of reminded me of the Albon years at Red Bull. You know, just wasn't happy, wasn't comfortable, and was never able to shake it off.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I laugh because Rob's face, you saying Kevin Magnussen wasn't, you know, a generational talent. Rob was, huh?
But I was waiting for Drew, because like Drew always carried a bit of a torch for K-Mag. And I'll be honest, I'm coming around to it. I always thought like, I don't know, the guy seems a bit of a prat. But like, you know, I think it might have been the end of that last season or early this one when it was clear Mag was rejoining the team. And I sort of joked. I was like, Schumacher needs to tape his picture to his locker and just like, this is who you have to defeat. Like, this is like, you know, he is the Minotaur of Haas, really. Like, he saw Romain off. And now, you know, if you're not careful, he will do the same to you. But like, Magnussen, I mean,
he also lost his seat and only got back because a war started. So it's not like he's been, you know,
kept him on. Yeah, he lost his seat, I think, predominantly because that team was broke. That team was that team was in pretty hard shape. But I guess here's my thinking about. Like, I'm kind of with you. I think it seems like it'd be a very hard road back for Mick, barring a turn in another series, maybe that gets some buzz around him. But with Hulkenberg, I also kind of wonder if you're Haas, it seems like one of the real issues with Mick was that, to the point they're talking about in the press, we mentioned it, but like Mick cracked up a lot of cars this year. Like, he was an expensive driver to run, and Haas is not in a position where they can just absorb tons of write-offs on these cars. And more importantly, they are dependent on so many other suppliers for their parts that, like, if a chassis goes in the bin, it is not a guaranteed thing that there is another one ready to go or that they can acquire easily. And so I wonder if you're Gunther Steiner, and yes, you made some gains, you're going to have a much bigger budget, this year than you've had in the past. But is there something like, is this maybe the perfect lineup for you, where you get two really steady hands? Hopefully, you know, Hulkenberg in his comments talks about how relaxed he feels about things. If you're Gunther Steiner, what you want here maybe is just like two really stable drivers to keep the cars intact, get the points when they are on the table, and not make like the desperate moves or the rookie moves that cost you a lot of money and position.
That's exactly how I see it, and I think it is the smart thing to do for Haas.
Well, especially because Haas is such a weird team because they are so dependent on like third-party parts suppliers. But the other thing is, they aren't really a support team properly. They have relationships with other teams, but like, despite where they sit in the field, they're not actually a good place to develop rookie talent. They really aren't. They can't afford the cost of doing this. And I do wonder if like between this season and last year, dealing with someone like Nikita Mazepin, with even if you set aside the persona issues, it was yet just such a clear case of, yep, we got another rookie coming in that just is not cut out for this. And I do wonder if like Gunther just wants some grizzled old veterans to drive the goddamn car and keep it on the track.
Yeah, and they don't have the budget to pull someone like Sebastian Vettel or Fernando Alonso, but the journeyman driver is perfect for them. So I'll be anxious to see how they do next year. The other confirmation here in the Formula One seats, Logan Sargeant will be racing for Williams next year. He is coming from Formula 2. He is an American driver. We haven't had an American driver since 2015. And his name is Logan Sargeant. So
pretty good. Yeah.
As American names go, Yeah, pretty good. Yeah, as you alluded to, Danny, there was a stipulation set out by Williams team principal Jost Capito earlier this season, saying we want Sargeant to be our driver, but he has to get the proper super license points, meaning he has to finish well in the Formula 2 championship standings. He did so. He secured fourth in the final driver standings for Formula 2 after the Abu Dhabi round of Formula 2. So he's got him, and he is in. So looking forward to how he does.
Yeah, good for American viewership as well. A little bit squeaky there. He could have done it in Interlagos and didn't, and then he had a little bit of fortune. There was a retirement in front of him in the F2 race, and he did some pretty good passes near the end. So yeah, when the heat was on, he managed to do it.
He is 21 years old, from Florida.
Love it.
But we won't hold that against him. In other driver news, Daniel Ricciardo hasn't confirmed anything yet, although Christian Horner has confirmed that there is an offer on the table for him to return to Red Bull as a support driver. So doing things like show runs, marketing duties, maybe some development stuff. Ricciardo himself, when asked about IndyCar, says that, you know, I've had, in this quote from motorsport.com, I've had a lot of IndyCar drivers reach out and say, like, mate, you would love it here. They were very enthusiastic and spoke very highly of the series. And I'm not saying I wouldn't. The racing looks great. But let's say I think mentally I'm just not there at the moment. I'm still kind of with Formula One in my mind. Sometimes transcriptions of the way people talk are tough to recompute into speech. He also says that, or when talking about it in October, he said that ovals scare me.
Yes.
10 years ago, I would have said, yes, I'm okay to admit that I'm not okay with ovals.
Yeah.
He also has, as this article points out, twice sampled supercars, the Australian, this is basically like Australian NASCAR, but they race on circuits instead of ovals. For promotional runs. Very fun series. But it seems like he's fully focused on sticking around F1, waiting in the wings for maybe a 2024 seat.
I think we now won the clock back. Maybe his move out of Red Bull is not an all-time worst F1 decision, but to have it all come back here now as a reserve driver does indicate that, like, it is a reverse Midas situation in terms of like career development. And I think, you know, I go back to that Drive to Survive where that buddy he ended up with in court over like management fees, helping counsel him through whether he was like,
God, I forgot
his manager was like a bro, and then his bro was like, so your bro gets 20% of your earnings, right? And it goes to court and it turns into a whole mess, but like, to have it all go this way is really rough. Now, I stand by that move was probably the right one. I think the move out of Renault just seems like that was where things went really, really wrong. I think if he stays at Renault, I think he'd been with that team through some rough times and was showing some real form. And I think, you know, he might have been this world where I think he ends up being like a beloved, era-defining driver for Renault Alpine, and instead we come to this. But I'm curious, what do we think the game plan here is? Like, one, is Christian just sentimental? Like, it, you know, as hard-edged as these bastards can be, this seems like such a, I guess if you wanted to like take the darkest view of it, maybe it's like, yeah, you come crawling back.
Yeah, that's where I kind of go with it a little bit.
Getting like, the reserve dog pound.
Whenever Christian's asked about it, Daniel, he always talks about how well he did at Red Bull and how he never materialized that talent in other teams. So, yeah, I don't know. I think he's a super competitive guy and is kind of just, yeah, a mixture of the two, maybe. Like, hey, come back and do some work with us because you're probably best known for your stint here at this stage. And also, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if over the past couple of months, I've come to sort of get a better, or at least my understanding of Ricciardo's issues has to do with this spec of car more than it has to do with any one team, maybe. I'm not quite sure, because the McLaren had a good car. Like, Lando was driving the wheels off of it and getting good points, and Daniel was just never able to do it. So I don't know. I don't know if he stayed at Alpine as the same thing happened. It's a messy career, because still he can't point at a thing and say that's why. He can't say I was in a bad team. He can't say I had a dodgy relationship with the principal, or I never got on with my teammate, or I never got what was deserved to me, or communications were bad. He just couldn't drive the new cars, like, and at multiple teams.
So that, like, happens. Who's picking, like, Schumacher, who's picking this guy up? Once the cars got rid of the Trez, was never the same driver.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, Daniel was never that guy either, right? He was never a championship-winning driver. He was never really in the fight for championships, honestly, even in his years with Red Bull. So it's, I think he ends up leaving the sport looking like a bit of a Hulkenberg, like somebody who just needs a seat to open up somewhere, and by the grace of God, just have them ask for him to come.
I mean,
I think it's wise of Red Bull to hang on to him, either for AlphaTauri, or for, you know, if they, my cynical side says, well, they can just keep treating Sergio Perez terribly. And if he opts to leave, Daniel Ricciardo can step in. Daniel is a known quantity. You know, he won't have to, you know, get used to the team, cause he already knows them. They can probably get him cheaper for them than what they were paying him when he left, because he now, you know, beggars can't be choosers. He wants a seat.
He's got that wine money. He's fine.
It's true. So, yeah, I don't know. Rob, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I just, you know, it is possible it is just a very generous offer to keep him, like, race current, and basically, like, let him hang out and see if something shakes loose in the next year or two. Also, I do think there's enough dynamism in motorsport right now where having a driver with that sort of rep and experience level under contract could end up being useful in other ways that we can't quite foresee yet. In terms of, you know, other racing series where opportunities might open up or something. But it's just such a weird twist in this story. I think it would be if I'm Ricciardo, it's a very hard thing to come back to. But yeah, not an embarrassment of options here.
Well, let's move on to the next story, Danny.
Yeah, I got two quickies here. First one is sort of a bizarre announcement, honestly. F1 announces a new all-female series called F1 Academy to start in 2023. So this from Race Fans. Apparently this new championship, F1 Academy, will run across 7 triple header race weekends next year. A total of 15 cars will contest 21 rounds. So I looked up what's going on with W Series. Obviously, they sort of quit this year to focus on fundraising for next year. It seems like if this gets the go-ahead, then, or has gotten the go-ahead, that perhaps that's not a great sign for W Series involvement in the F1 calendar next year, at least.
I don't know. Read on. Sorry? I don't know about that. Because this is, I mean, they're saying here that the idea is that this will be like a series where then they would jump to W Series or Formula 3, Formula 2, that kind of thing. The car is about half as powerful as the W Series cars. It's 160 horsepower to like 270 for W Series. So I don't think it's meant as a replacement for W Series.
I don't think so either. Sorry, just to finish they said it, according to Race Fans, pulling from whoever is running this thing, they said it's not intended as a rival to W Series, which of course we know we've been covering for years, and in more recent years was a support series for F1. It wasn't always. They sort of like built up to that. And they have said that it is supposed to allow drivers to progress into W Series, Formula 3, Formula 2, and Formula 1. Like you said, the cars are lower spec. The mentor investment for each driver, which this academy is going to do, was obviously at a much lower rate than W Series. But I do wonder if W Series is in legitimate difficult financial situation, if they can't finish a season, that I do wonder if this is F1 basically taking the first steps into bringing what has now been established as a seemingly big growth market. W Series did well over the, you know, it grew over the, you know, 4 or 5 seasons it's been around. That this is them putting their sort of hand on the, on it and sort of taking their first steps into owning women's racing going forward as well, because we don't know if W Series is going to come back next year.
I see what you mean. It could act more like a backstop in case W Series does go away,
and also maybe like if the goal here is that they're going to be progressing into you know, if they're going to be progressing into things like Formula 3, Formula 2. This is definitely a, we are trying to widen the intake at the end of the pipeline, and try, because you could always, I think one of the things that organizations often do, industries feels this is a routine thing, if you blame the pipeline, right? You're like, well, we're just, you know, during, because this, the way people are sorted out and people drop out, it is, there's an attrition rate, and it's just like, you're going to get very, very few like people, some sort of marginalized identity at one end of it. In F1, that does have some grounds where, like, W Series, the problem is it's kind of parallel to the feeder system that the F1 teams like to use. And so I guess if you're saying, like, we're going to get more women into the actual feeder series and have them come up and be in the places where teams tend to recruit from, that's going to you know, improve the chances down the road.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's key, because what this differs from something like W Series, because W Series is, it's like, this is where W Series is where you land when you have experience as a female driver.
Yeah.
Getting that experience is the hard part, or is one of the hard parts, right? And so the F1 Academy, they have 3 races per round, and they don't run on F1 weekends, which means they get more track time. So that was actually a downside of running with F1 weekends for W Series, because you only had your very limited sessions and then the race. So I think this is, you know, I think they'll, I hope they work well in tandem with each other. I should say, there's 7 rounds planned. One of them will be on an F1 weekend, but the other ones are not, for that reason.
It's cool. I think the other thing that it's great, obviously, that there's more investment happening into women's racing and trying to like stop all these sort of systemic issues with getting talent or you know, giving talent the time to develop. I think the other thing that maybe in my sort of cynical view, or I don't know, maybe it's not cynical, but the other thing that this does is take the other strategy, which W Series could have done, and there was sort of criticism of it at one stage, which was that the average age of the drivers in W Series was higher, was like misaligned with the average sort of intake into F1 and F2 and F3 these days, right? Yeah. So that's where I find that over the course of a couple of years, I can see this making W Series redundant if they're able to basically...
Yep.
You know, because people, I'm assuming the drivers will have to choose, because there will be some that will fall into both catchments, right? Like the younger drivers, because there are now younger drivers going into W Series. But instead of these established drivers who like never had their day, which was very much the start of it, having younger talent come in, it will make a lot more sense for them to go into F1 Academy if we have this sort of, you know, the teams are being managed by F2 teams, the cars are, you know, there's, I mean, I know there's parallels with W Series, but I can see it sort of almost making W Series redundant. You know,
that's
what I mean?
A really good point.
Skipping it, yeah.
I think the idea was, we're going to showcase like the great talent that's out there among women drivers. But yes, teams want to start like molding drivers when they're like 12 years old, and make final decisions about their careers when they're like 17 or 18. And so W Series was supposed to be like maybe like the ultimate feeder system or recruiting ground for like female talent. But the problem is it ends up sort of positioned as a capstone for a driver's career.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this addresses that to some extent. It's a thing whose impact we will see in years, right? Like the success of this is going to be measurable in probably like 2 or 3 years, whether we are seeing people actually get promoted out of this and into some viable racing seats and academy spots with major teams.
Yeah, but I think you're right with the age thing, because people are saying Nyck DeVries, oh, he's old to get his rookie season. He's 27.
Yeah, it's wild.
I mean,
it's just, yeah. And that's a new thing. Like that's not,
this is not how F1 used to be. This is it was. It is so strange. I've listened to Beyond the Grid very, very slowly. So literally I'm like 2 years back and I'm listening to like interviews with some of the greats. The Alan Jones interview, just incredible, by the way. Like go and listen to that.
Yeah, check it out.
The subtext of some of these interviews, that Frank Williams just seems like an absolute bastard to have done business with back in the day. terrific. But Jean Alesi like sort of gave these remarks. Like for him, one of the key differences is, you know, in his day when you come into F1, you're still a young man, but you are a man. You've had life experiences and you have perspective. And he finds it so strange the way, you know, it's an Ender's Game situation, right? They are kids who've been like drilled and refined on racing and racing only through formative years. And then they're sort of dumped into it and they don't have that sort of like final psychological setting that happens with adulthood. And
You can see it with somebody who arguably maybe does not fit this mold exactly, but with Sebastian Vettel, with all of his interviews, the guy's excited to just live a normal life. Like,
yeah,
it's so strange. He's just like, I don't know what I'll do, but I'm excited. I won't have like a structure given to me. I've always had structure in my life, which has been the sport, you know, since I was a child. So strange. Like, what a weird, like you said, it is Ender's Game. It's like these weird little, you know, lab babies that were like made to drive in these cars.
Well, that's the other thing. Is like Alesi in that interview mentions, like if you were a driver learning your trade back in like the late 70s, early 80s, you got experience out on the track. And that was it. Like between races, like there's only so much you could really do. And now with simulators, and he was like with video replay, telemetry, like they just study and study and study racing. Yeah. In some ways that makes them better drivers, but yeah, very different like work-life balance that they're dealing with even at an early age. But you mentioned Vettel and the send-off he got. Danny, you want to guess this next story?
It was speaking of work-life balance. Yeah, I just think people should read this. I'm sure Drew will include it in the show notes. There's a lovely little article on Race Fans about this dinner that all the drivers did. You might have seen pictures on social media of the whole grid having a big sort of like group hug after their dinner, or maybe before their dinner, or during in Abu Dhabi. Apparently it was set up by Hamilton as a farewell to Vettel, but obviously you had other drivers there, like Nicholas Latifi, for instance, and Danny Ric, who may also be.
I think they were all there.
They're all, no, I'm just saying Latifi obviously won't be driving at F1 next year either, and Ricardo maybe as well. In the future, we don't know, obviously. So a couple of nice quotes here. Hamilton said, I thought it was really important, so that's why I asked in Mexico whether they would be open to all doing a dinner to give Seb a farewell. We haven't had a dinner together since years ago in China. And there's loads of quotes in here. It has the vibes of like a office Christmas party where everyone realizes that they might actually get along a bit more than they do on a day-to-day basis. I just have a couple of quotes here. Albon said, Nicky and I were the first to arrive. It's Latifi, obviously. He said, we were 5 minutes late and we were the first by 20 minutes. So we got to sit next to each other, which I thought was so funny. Like, everyone was 25 minutes late, except they were late, but they're sort of the young bucks, so they still were earlier than everyone.
Oh, amazing.
The busy life of an F1 driver. There's some great Fernando Alonso quotes where he basically is talking about just being an old man and like all these young kids. He's like, they're all so nice to each other and they take pictures and it's, he says, it's nice, but it's different, but it's nice. It's nice that they all get on. We all get along, but it's different. It wasn't like this in my day. You had people like Mika Hakkinen. There's like, it's just like a sort of an old man grumbling to his neighbor, which I thought was quite fun. He's got a big smile on his face in the photograph, next to Vettel. And then Russell, I think, sort of with the sensible sort of capstone on this conversation, a lot more fun than we probably would have expected. We've sort of said we need it more often, which I think is like a very office party at Christmas. We should all hang out more. This was cool, you know, yeah. Right before they all go back to their constituencies for 3 months or whatever. So yeah, you know, we're all fans of these lads. It's nice when we see them all, see our celebrities hanging out with each other and having a good time. And like,
it is cool. There's some good photos in there.
And to what we were saying about, like, you know, the whole young driver thing, like, there are very few people in the world. To me, it gives me the vibes of, like, when you see war veterans getting together every year, you know what I mean? For their, like, yeah, remembrance meals or whatever, where it's like, there is a very small pool of people that have the experiences of these individuals in the world.
Yeah.
Even to the point where, like Rob was saying about John Lacey, where, like, even he feels out of touch with modern drivers. So the pool is within a pool. And even Alonso does. You know, he had a different growing up to these guys. But so I think it is really important. A couple of quotes in there were talking about how they just see each other a lot more often because of the amount of races, because of the way that COVID changed how they bubble and socialize outside of F1 on race weekends. You know, it seems like they see each other a lot more. So maybe a bit of that IndyCar, you know, barbecue sauce that Roman Grosjean enjoyed so much. Maybe it's
RVs going around Europe.
It's coming to F1. That's Drive to Survive season 5. It's just like, do the... Get all these guys to do the what was that American race, coast to coast? What was it called again?
The Gumball Rally.
The Gumball. Run. Get them to do the Gumball 3000.
Gumball Run, the movie. I am curious what you make of Hamilton. Was sort of joking. He thinks Vettel's not really done.
Alonso too. They both said it in interviews. It was very funny. Yeah,
I am curious because if there's one dude I could see just like completely ghosting. Like racing, I could see Vettel being the one. Like, always seemed the most retiring. Every interview he always gave seemed like, to some extent, there's a part of him that wants to like go sit in his, you know,
his
farm in the mountains or whatever.
Fix motorcycles,
and, like, and tinker and like hang with his kids. But you know, you do that for a few months, and it's nice. But your whole life has been built around doing this one thing and these rhythms. And so, I don't know. Do you think he's truly done? Do you think he comes back to F1? Or do you think he's racing somewhere?
Yeah, I think he's done. I think you're not wrong. And I think there's always it's a very, like, alluring thought. They drag me back in again. But I find Vettel to be... More than anything else, I find him to be more thoughtful and in touch with his own emotions than practically everyone else on the grid, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he'd know if he wasn't done. And I think he's done. But I wouldn't be surprised either way either. But yeah, I've really enjoyed listening to his interviews over the past couple of years. And he has gotten more zen. Like, don't get me wrong, earlier when I'm saying that, like, you know, the respectful driver, a lot, you know, it's like the last 5 minutes of a movie. If the last 5 minutes of a movie makes you happy, then you probably walk out and tell everyone it was great. And obviously Vettel has been very respectful in these parts of his career. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm happy for him not to race anymore. And I feel like he's in touch with that. And I don't think he has that type of fight in him anymore. Or maybe he does, and it's for issues outside of racing.
All right, well, we're done with this episode. You can join our Shift F1. Sorry, you can't join our Shift F1 Fantasy League.
It's over.
The doors are closed. Emails, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. Send them in for next week's podcast. You can also hit us up on @shiftf1podcast on Twitter. I'm @DrewScanlon. That is @DannyO'Dwyer and @RobZachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world of racing, Danny?
Let's race around the world one more time in 2023. Yeah, I guess. Or maybe we will again in the future. Who knows?
It's still 2022, but we've only got two things on the weekend that I could find. Extreme E is racing at Punta del Este in Uruguay. And the World Touring Car Championship is racing in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah this weekend. Final thoughts on Abu Dhabi, Danny.
sending those emails, everyone, please. We'll do a big email episode next time. It would be a good shout. Abu Dhabi was a race that I enjoyed very much from my freezing cold tent in the Mendocino Forest.
Amazing.
I have to catch up on some World Cup games now.
Final thoughts, Rob.
So I said I'm glad F1 is over. And I was ready to see the end of the season. It was it was sort of a spent force as far as exciting stories. I was glad we ended up with two interesting races at the end, one great race and one interesting one. I think more it is that I'm ready for the next season. That's the real curse of this, is like I'm no sooner I'm like, oh God, just the season is done. Let's put stick a fork in it. Then I'm already thinking about, man, I can't wait until we start getting like the first word on testing and, you know, see who the off-season hires and job transfers are, because that is always an interesting market where you see people go hunting for engineers and such. what the pending arrival, it's a few years out, of, you know, operations like Audi are going to mean for you know, the sporting landscape, the technical landscape. And so that's kind of where I'm at. Is the weird thing is you know, last year was really unusual in that the season was live and exciting right up until the end. You couldn't even think about like next year, hardly at all. It was just full. It was completely overwhelming.
It's true.
And here, you know, for a few weeks, I've been sort of thinking about, man, I'm so curious with all the new faces and like the reshuffling of this order, what next year is going to bring for F1, because I genuinely have no idea. I love that.
Well, if you would like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.